My name is Dan Spencer, and the title of this session is Good News to the Poor, the Church in El Salvador. We want to just begin with a little bit of introduction to ourselves, maybe what our connection is with El Salvador, but the basic outline of the session today is to spend roughly the first half giving you some background on both the country of El Salvador and the situation of the church there, but then save a good half of the session for discussion and your questions. I'll lead off and just mention my own connection with El Salvador. It goes back primarily about 10 years. In 1980, I began my studies at Union Theological Seminary in New York. And I, 2 years prior to that, had lived in Costa Rica for 8 months. And that was where I began to first get connected with Central Americans, but I didn't know a whole lot about El Salvador. But within 2 months of me being in New York in seminary, there were two massacres in El Salvador, two massacres that got the headlines. In November of 1980, six leaders of an opposition organization called the Democratic Revolutionary Front, the FDR, were kidnapped from their organizational meeting, and their bodies appeared the next day, scattered throughout the city and the countryside. And then about a little over a week later, four American churchwomen returning from the airport to San Salvador were apprehended, it turns out, by the National Guard. And again, their bodies were later found tortured and buried in a grave nearby. So within a couple months, El Salvador was really in the headlines here. Archbishop Romero had been assassinated a few months earlier in March of 1980. And I found myself in seminary grappling with the questions of the church in El Salvador, as there were many people there who were active in that. Where it really became real for me was 2 years later, when I went back to Costa Rica to study in the Latin American Biblical Seminary. And 1982 was a year of tremendous repression in El Salvador. And the air war was beginning to pick up. The U.S. was introducing planes and bombing techniques in El Salvador. So literally tens of thousands of people were fleeing El Salvador, and many of them came to Costa Rica. And I ended up working with Salvadoran refugee children, as well as studying with several Salvadorans in the Latin American Biblical Seminary. Then from 1984 until 1989, just last year, I worked in an organization called the Center for Global Education, located at Augsburg College in Minnesota. And much of our work involved organizing and leading study seminars for church groups and other groups to Central America. So that brought me in contact regularly with the people of El Salvador. About every 3 or 4 months, I would spend a week in El Salvador. It's actually where I met Maureen several years ago. And so that gave me some contact with things. And Maureen, why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay. I actually was fairly ignorant about what was going on in El Salvador. I remember in 1980, I was finishing my nurse's training in a small private school. I walked into the library one day, which I'd never taken time to do, and picked up a National Catholic Reporter, which during my childhood we had received that, but I hadn't read it for years, and it was March of 1980, and the whole issue was about Romero. And I sat and read the whole issue and walked out of the library that day and said, I'm a different person. I didn't know what that meant, but... and then for 2 years I actually worked in northern Minnesota and worked in the, I thought the big pressing issue of the day was the nuclear arms issue, and worked desperately for a nuclear freeze. And in 82, I decided that I needed to learn Spanish, because I wanted to work with migrant workers. And I was kind of burned out because I realized that I wasn't going to be able to stop nuclear war, so I thought I would try to find something a little more manageable that I could maybe change. And so I ended down in Mexico, which must have been fall of 1982, to study Spanish. And there I met some Salvadoran refugees, and I heard their stories. And again, it was it really changed me. I had to look at the world a little differently. And by chance, I met some people who were going to be working in a refugee camp. I thought, gosh, you know, that would be a good thing for me to do. And as it turned out, they were looking for someone to run a nutrition center. So that spring of 84, suddenly I found myself in the middle of a refugee camp with very limited Spanish skills, and suddenly in charge of a nutrition center for Salvadorans who had fled their country because of the tremendous repression. And I worked a year in the refugee camp, and then was invited by the Mennonite Central Committee to work in El Salvador for 3 years. And I worked there until January of 87. So it's been, I visited again just a year ago this time.
What we'd like to do before going into some more of the presentations, just have a chance to hear from you all. And I'd like to just ask the question, when you think of the church in El Salvador, what comes to mind for you, and what are some of the questions that come up for you? And maybe you want to mention when you first heard of the church in El Salvador, what that may have triggered any awareness you've got at this point about what's going on in the church there.
I want to know, where is the Pope in all this?
Where is the Pope?
I'm serious. Not in a blaming way, but I've never understood that. Absence. Profound absence.
I was privileged to visit in El Salvador 3 years ago and visited Madara Gomez's church, and was aware then of a tremendous persecution of members of his church. Three the previous month had been captured and tortured because they were working with refugees. So that was my first awareness, folks.
We want to talk a little bit later about the Lutheran Church, in particular in El Salvador. For those of you who may not know, Medardo Gomez is the pastor of Resurrection Lutheran Church in San Salvador, and also the bishop of the Lutheran Church of El Salvador. Any other comments or questions, Judy?
I'd be interested in your reflections on how it is that that part of the church, which identifies with the poor, is allowed to continue to exist, okay. And how you understand the sort of precariousness of its ongoing existence.
The term that started being bandied about around the time when Merrill was assassinated, liberation theology, I've heard that everything from, you know, the best thing since sliced bread to a horrible apostasy. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is that I'm hearing about 18 different definitions of it. And how does that fit with our understanding of the gospel?
And I'll be doing a session pretty much devoted to liberation theology tomorrow, but we can certainly, you can't talk about the Church in El Salvador without making some reference to it, so we'll get a bit of it today as well. John?
I've had a long time interest in community, and I was doing some study here at Holden. I had a month to do that in August of 84, and studied base Christian communities at Holden Village. And there was a certain built-in irony in that. It's kind of appropriate, but then that following spring had a chance to go down to visit in El Salvador and Nicaragua. I was interested in that as a revitalization of the church, just a powerful demonstration of what the church is and what we might learn from it. So I was not interested from a political point of view particularly, but when you went, you couldn't help but being drawn into that situation. Was there?
We're certainly going to talk some more about base Christian communities. Are most people here familiar with at least the term? Or is that a new term for some people? Okay, I see most people nodding, so some familiarity. Anything else before we're going to give a little bit of background? John? Or no? Okay.
I became more interested in El Salvador last fall, when it seemed like tension increased again. And in our community in Pocatello, Idaho, the mainline denominations decided to sign the same statement that the National Church of Bishops had signed and to call a press conference for doing that. And we wound up using our church, Good Shepherd Lutheran there, as the place for doing that. And I really had not kept up all that much, so I had to do a lot of extra work. And I was really amazed when we did the clips on the, they're on all networks of TV and all the radio stations and newspaper. We had as much coverage as you could possibly get. And they printed the whole statement, and there was a big, almost a quarter page thing on it. And it was something, I wound up feeling I got thrust into something I didn't really have any idea about. And with the letter and the copy of the letter that went to our congressman, he has kind of encouraged me to stay in touch with that issue, and we talk every once in a while. That's kind of the connection I had, and I feel like I'm kind of running behind all the time.
Yeah, there's always something happening in that region, it's true. Well, this is helpful, and let's, I think we'll move into so a little bit of presentation time to get us grounded at all at the same point. Just let you know about a little bit about our division of labor. I feel tremendously lucky that Maureen is in the village. In fact, I roped her at the last minute. She had no idea when she came up this weekend that I was going to ask her to do this. But Maureen is one of those people that I always sought out whenever I went to El Salvador so that I could ask what's really going on now. El Salvador is both a very simple reality and a very complex reality. And we'll paint some of the simple framework and then get into some of the complexities. And Maureen, having lived there for as many years as she did, really got a grasp of what was happening. And she'll be sharing more of that in the second part, particularly some of the experiences she had with Salvadoran people. What I'd like to do is get us grounded in the same point and do that by just a little bit of geographical overview and a little bit of historical overview on El Salvador. I don't have a great map here. This is the country of El Salvador, and it's unfortunately, I don't have a map of Central America, but El Salvador is the only country in Central America that only has a Pacific coast. The other countries all have borders on both the Pacific Ocean and the Caribbean Sea, or the Atlantic on the other side. El Salvador, to get you located, is about the size of Massachusetts, fairly small, less than maybe 100 miles wide and 250 miles long. It's the most densely populated country in Central America. And it's hard to get exact figures because of the mobility of the population. Over one-fifth of the population has been uprooted and is either refugees or internalized, dislocated people. But roughly 5 million people, somewhere between 4.5 and 5.5 million people, would call El Salvador home. And just geographically, it's got three major zones. There's a broad coastal plain area that's fairly flat and rich in agriculture, where a lot of the things like sugarcane and cotton are grown. Then it has a highlands area that runs through the middle of the country, a belt parallel to the coast, where the volcanoes are. This is the primary coffee growing region in El Salvador. That's where the wealth of the country is located in terms of the coffee growing industry, which brings in over half of El Salvador's annual income. The northern third of the country is very mountainous and has been heavily deforested, and so it is a very poor area agriculturally. And it is primarily subsistence farming, some grazing of animals. It's an area where Maureen has a lot of experience, so I'll hear from you more on that. But there's also a significant part of the population in that area as well. But the major cities, the city of San Salvador, located in the middle, some of the other cities like Santa Ana, San Miguel, tend to run through the intermediate area, the highlands area, where the coffee growing industry is located. Now, just to get us looking a little bit on the history of El Salvador, what we'll find out as we talk more and more about this, the church in El Salvador is really consists of at least two churches. It's a very divided church. And I put up here a couple quotes that I think probably represent two different parts of this church. One is a quote from Christopher Columbus, and we'll be hearing more about him in the next couple of years. And he wrote, "Gold is a wonderful thing. Its owner is master of all he desires. Gold can enable souls to enter paradise." And then a quote from Archbishop Romero we'll talk a little bit more about, who at one point in his reflections said, "If they kill me, I will be resurrected in the struggles of the Salvadoran people. And would that my blood be the seed of liberty, if indeed I am killed." Two very different theologies represented here. we'll talk a little bit more about that. But the quote by Columbus, I think, is very indicative of the kind of church that first took root in much of Latin America, which has later been the Church of the Conquest, or it's known as Conquest Theology. It's a church that brought with both the sword and the Bible together, and was very much aligned for several hundred years in Latin America. It's what we call it the triangle of power. The three sectors of the society that ruled much of Latin America for many hundreds of years would have been the army, the wealthy, and the church. The wealthy controlling the political power and the wealth, the army protecting that political power, and the church giving its blessing to that and basically serving for ideological justification of this arrangement. Now, this was a small minority in terms of numbers of people, but a great concentration of wealth and political power in the hands of the few. And for many, many years, the church served as the primary justification for this arrangement. There were always some prophetic minorities that protested against this, but by and large, the majority of the church would have fit this schema. And so in the 1500s, you have the conquest of Latin America, including what now we know as El Salvador. This continues for about 400 years, well, 300 plus years, until in the early 1800s, you get political independence of many of the former colonies from Spain. But the arrangement of societal sectors stays pretty much the same throughout the 1800s. A very critical event takes place in the 1880s in El Salvador. And that is, the late 1800s were a political struggle between two primary political parties, the conservatives and the liberals. Conservatives wanted to maintain this traditional kind of feudal structure. And they had control during the middle part of the 1800s. But by the late 1800s, the liberals were coming into power. And the liberals were noted by wanting to modernize the economy of these countries, to move them from being a primarily rural, feudal-based system to having them be integrated in the emerging global economy, DM.
At what point does El Salvador become a distinct nation?
Well, it's a little tricky. From 1821 to 1823 is when the five countries of Central America become independent. But there's about a 15-year period there where these countries are one nation, a confederation of Salvador, Central American states. And by the late 1830s, that confederation has split up. So this is about 50 to 60 years after political independence from Spain. Thanks. Anyway, what's important about this is in order to do this, the liberals had to be able to concentrate, they had to get the land-dwelling people off of the land in order to be able to concentrate the land, in order to be able to consolidate agriculture into the modern economy. And this took place primarily because coffee, as an industry, was on the increase now. Coffee requires concentrations of land and requires intensive labor to be able to work that. So what happened in the 1880s at the end there is that the liberal governments made communal lands and the indigenous lands that were held in common illegal. Private property was the only property that was legal now. And there was tremendous land confiscations throughout El Salvador. The lands that traditionally had been held communally by the people were now confiscated and concentrated in the hands of primarily European families. An interesting phenomenon is that many of these families came over from Europe at this time in order to get this copy going, and many of them have non-Spanish surnames. You'll hear a lot of German, a lot of French. You'll hear about Roberto Dablison is a French surname, but you'll hear names like Guzman and Schmidt are big, powerful Salvador families. These families came over and consolidated the land, and now Salvador began to be known as run by the 14 families. Basically, the small, wealthy oligarchy was just a handful of families who had the wealth and they concentrated. The effect of this then was to impoverish great sectors of Salvadoran society. And by the early 1920s or so, there is a lot of upheaval going on, a social unrest in El Salvador as the majority of people become impoverished and can no longer make a living. A man named Farabundo Martí in the 1920s began to do a lot of labor organizing with these landless people, and he founded the Salvadoran Communist Party. He organized the people, and this culminated in 1932 when Martí and others initiated a strike in El Salvador to protest the social conditions and the land conditions. And what happened at that point is that the wealthy and the political elite called in the army to put down this labor unrest. And in space of 2 weeks, over 30,000 Salvadorans were massacred. So somewhere between 2 and 4% of the entire nation was killed in a 2 week period. This is really critical because it's known as La Matanza, the massacre. And there are still people in El Salvador alive today who remember it, and it is seared into the memory and the consciousness of the Salvadoran people. The other thing why this was such a watershed event is this for the first time brought the wealthy and the army together in a tight alliance where the army gained political power. And the army now, from 1932 until 1982, rules El Salvador as the political power in the country. Now, support with the wealthy having given them support, but the army now is in political power. That gives us some of the background for what happens in the 1960s. We're going to shift a little bit here. That's the social context. Now, what's happening with the church? The church protests against some of this, but by and large continues this pattern of alliance. Until the 1960s, a couple critical events take place. Worldwide, the Second Vatican Council between 1962 and 1965 serves to begin to modernize the Roman Catholic Church. And many of the things that become critical for El Salvador are things like the Bible becomes available to the people and becomes available in Spanish. The Mass is now spoken in Spanish. The church begins to put a heavy emphasis on the laity as having an equal and valid role of ministry to the clergy. And this becomes even more emphasized in 1968 when the bishops gather in the city of Medellin, Colombia, in a conference that's now known as the Medellin Conference, to try and implement the teachings of Vatican II into the Latin American reality. And many different important things happen out here, but one of the most important is the church now says it needs to be injected into the social reality of wherever it's found. The bishops in Medellin got together and said the reality of Latin America is poverty. We are a nation of poor people. And so out of the Medellin Conference comes a phrase that some of you may have heard, it's become a rallying cry in Latin America, called taking the preferential option for the poor. The recognition, since the majority of people in Latin America are poor, and to be the church means to take seriously this reality, means the church now takes a preferential option for the poor. Nowhere, I think, in the country, in Latin America, with the exception maybe of Brazil, did this have a greater effect than in El Salvador. And in the 1960s, you have increasingly priests and nuns going out to work with the poor to help them to begin to organize for their rights, particularly in the countryside, organizing peasant unions. And you have the start of what are called the base Christian communities. These are small Bible reflection groups of 10 or 15 people located in the same neighborhood or the same town, usually under lay leadership, a lay leader who's gotten training with nuns and priests, and they tend to gather weekly to reflect on their lives and reflect on the Bible in light of the reality of their lives. The base communities begin to catalyze development of popular movement in El Salvador, the coming together of the poor, both urban and rural settings, to start to work for social change. However, at the same time, you have the founding of a group called Orden, which is a paramilitary group set up to repress the emerging popular movement here. And so you have in the 1960s, the roots of both the development of the popular movement and the repression against the popular movement starting to happen. This continues through the 1970s. The popular movement begins to develop strength. The labor unions, the peasant unions begin to develop strength. There's a lot of protests going on there, and increasingly a lot of repression by the government. And so El Salvador becomes known internationally for violating human rights. It culminates at the end of the decade with the selection of Archbishop Oscar Romero. Monsignor Oscar Romero is the bishop of the country. And his 3 years of being bishop, from 1977 until his assassination in 1980, see the real shift of much of the church away from this schema, breaking with the alliance now, and the church now aligned with the poor, or at least certain important sectors of the church, and the army and the wealthy increasingly isolated from much of the church. Actually, what happens is there's a division of the church itself, and part of it goes with the poor, headed by Archbishop Romero. Other sectors stay aligned with the army and the wealthy, and so you have a tremendous polarization in the church now. This culminates during this time, 16 priests are killed, literally thousands of lay Catholic leaders. You have the assassinations of the four American church women, and then finally culminating in 1980 with the assassination of the Archbishop of the country himself. The 1980s see a continued polarization. The repression now deepens so much that it develops into a civil war, as those who began the popular movement, which by and large in the 1970s was a nonviolent movement for social change, become by the end of the 1970s convinced that nonviolent social change is impossible in El Salvador because of the repression of the army. So they take up arms, and you have a civil war breaking out there. That's some of the social context for what is happening in during this time. And the question we need to ask then is, what does it mean to be church in a context like that? This is what the Salvadorans have been asking. And much of the development then is the church, increasingly sectors of the church, living out this preferential option of the poor by taking sides with the poor who are organizing themselves in the popular movement. And so you hear actually a shift from the term preferential option for the poor, which somehow gives you an image that we're not poor, we're just opting for the poor, to in El Salvador calling it the church of the poor, recognizing that the church itself is of the poor. It's the poor themselves make up the church. And therefore, if the gospel needs to be preached within that reality, and the reality of El Salvador, one of suffering and repression. I'm going to stop there, I think, with that on some background and let Maureen fill you in just in some of her experiences of how this actually takes flesh among the Salvadoran people. And then we'll have some time for discussion.
Well, I think probably the thing that impressed me the most when I first went to El Salvador was, you know, sitting down with some of the peasants and reading the gospel together, and just the profound impact of hearing that God wants as much for them to have three meals a day, to have health care, to have education, as God does for the rich. And that realization was just so profound. There's just generation after generation of poor self-esteem. I remember when I first went to the refugee camps, I spoke horrible Spanish. And I didn't realize how horrible till I was ready to leave. And when I first got there, I told the people, I said, please teach me Spanish. You need to correct me. But I was kind of revered as the person with all the knowledge coming in to teach them, and they just felt like they had so little to impart to me. And by the end of that, fortunately, that relationship changed, and they were able to, when I was leaving, they would start pantomiming and mimicking how I was when I first got there, and imitating my Spanish, which was totally horrifying to me to realize that how I started out. But also what that spoke to me was just a real liberation, but also what that liberation meant. I remember when I first started meeting with a group of women and asking them to. I wanted their participation in trying to do some public health kinds of nutritional work in the camps, and I just kind of felt like I had to come up with the ideas. And the last meeting that I had with them, we were sitting around, and one of the most quiet women that I'd been working with, I presented my idea, wanted to see what they thought. And she stopped and said, "But Maureen, we can't do it that way because of this, this, and this." And I kind of went, "Oh," and I realized that I started realizing more and more what that means as you join into people. I guess having come from a power base and just that whole sense of for other people to be liberated, we also need to let go of some of our own control. And and that as people take charge of their own lives. I remember one older man who was in his 80s, who actually said this to me one day. He said basically that just the realization that we are people of God, he said, and he basically said that, and what this means is that we have a right to eat three meals a day, to education for our children, to health care, just as much as the rich people in our country have a right to that. And what looking at the historical context that Dan has just laid out for us, just what a truly revolutionary thought that is. But also the kind of self-esteem that comes from realizing that God has created this life for me as much as anyone else. I guess another story, just in terms of kind of this whole process, I worked out in a Catholic parish in the eastern side of the country with some priests and nuns, and their story really kind of exemplified what the historical component that Dan was talking about. I came a little later in the story, but I came in at the point when there was refugees living in this town. But when the priests and nuns first moved out to this town, probably in the early 70s, they were trying to take the Vatican II documents and the documents from Medellin and trying to look at how they could begin implementing these documents in their parish. And so they started study groups and prayer groups and groups of reflecting and then kind of let the people take it from there, and that evolved into starting cooperatives. Eventually, by the time I got there, all their what they were called catechists, who were the lay leaders, were no longer there because of the tremendous repression. They had to, in the late 70s, early 80s, make the decision as to whether they were going to flee for their lives. Many chose to flee to Honduras, which is where I worked the first year, out of fear of losing their lives. Some chose to take up arms and to fight for more political space, to create the kind of society they felt was more equitable. And some people stopped speaking and tried to go on living their lives very quietly. But basically, by the time I got there, the parish was a very different parish, and people were very afraid to even start working with me in terms of forming any kind of health groups in their villages because of the tremendous repression. They'd seen so many of their neighbors and their families who had started developing cooperatives and literacy groups were the ones that were targeted during the intensive repression. It's kind of general, I don't know.
Yeah, well, maybe we can start with a few of these questions here, or if there are questions that are immediate in people's mind from some of that, points of clarification, anything. Yeah.
One of the questions I have is, what's happening right now? I mean, where does El Salvador stand right now? I work with children. I teach bilingual students in Los Angeles, and right downtown, so I see them as they come in, and mm-hmm. So I'm kind of wondering what's happening now.
I think, you know, it's interesting. I think Los Angeles now is the second largest Salvadoran city in the world. It is the second largest number of Salvadorans of a city in the world, second only to San Salvador. So if you're in Southern California, you'll come in contact with lots of them.
The stories the kids have told are incredible. After, you know, I was trying to keep up with what was happening, and after a while there was so much happening that I just kind of shut it all out and just worked with them. But I'm kind of curious as to, you know, especially after I heard things were starting to escalate again. You know, what's, where do
Do you want to speak to what?
Maybe I can just say it has to do with someone brought up the point of the, yeah, you talked about the increase in tensions in last fall. That maybe sets a little context. Maureen and Ted were there just prior to that. Basically, very briefly, at the end, there were dialogue talks going on, peace talks, the initial stages between the government and the guerrillas to try and find some way of negotiating a solution. And in the end of October, there were a series of bomb attacks in San Salvador, one placed in the Committee of Mothers of the Disappeared, another one placed in one of the labor union groups, and one of the labor union headquarters killed 10 labor union leaders. So at that point, the guerrillas broke off the peace talks, that this is not a context in which we can continue these. About two weeks later, the guerrillas initiated a major offensive in San Salvador, the center of the country, but also in several of the other cities throughout the country. And we're able to take several of the neighborhoods in the capital city of San Salvador. During that offensive, the army put under a state of siege the country, and particularly several sectors of the city. That was the time during which the massacre of the 6 Jesuits, their housekeeper and her daughter, took place. He was the direct, one of the Jesuits was the rector or the president of the Central American University, which is a Jesuit university. They also killed the dean and several of the other professors there. And so this was, again, a traumatizing situation for the church there. These were all of the, primarily the Jesuits were the ones who had been working very hard trying to find a negotiated solution to the war, trying to find some way out of the war through nonviolent means. But there were also somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 people, civilians killed in the city at that time. The army did massive bombing of the poor neighborhoods to try and drive the guerrillas out. So that set a lot of the increased repression. And then after that time, in the months following that, there was a lot of targeting different groups to try and sort of mop them up. Afterwards, several of the international church workers were expelled from the country. Many of the other church workers, the Salvadoran church workers, went underground or went into exile. We talked a little bit about the Lutheran church. It was a very frightening time for them. The government came and ransacked their headquarters. Many people feel that Medardo Gomez would have been killed at the same time as the Jesuits, except that he had already gone underground. And I was in Central America shortly after that, and one of the things that was just striking is every place I went, I kept running into Salvadoran Lutherans in Honduras, in Guatemala, in Nicaragua. They were in Mexico, some had come to the United States. Basically, the leadership of the church fled. And this happened not only with the Lutherans, it happened with the Episcopalians, it happened with the Baptists, it happened with many of the Catholics as well. There was tremendous repression unleashed against the Catholic Church, who were accused, these people were accused of being the front organizations for the guerrillas during the November offensive. Since that time, there has been some lessening of the tensions, enough so that many of the church leaders have gone back to El Salvador. But a very frightening period of time, and now the guerrillas and the government have set some timelines in September to begin trying to negotiate again. But still very high levels of repression there, and certainly high levels of fear going on right now. I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
No.
Okay.
I just was recalling how divided families were, even in El Salvador. When we were at the Jesuit school, I remember someone showing us the photographs of their graduating classes and saying, here in this graduating class here, this man is a leader here in the government, and this man is a general in the army. This man became a priest, and this one was working with the poor, but he was killed. And just going through, this was a graduating class of a particular year, and the interconnections between people, so that people have a sense of there's advanced communication. Everybody knows what's going on. I remember it was, last fall, Medardo Gomez was seeking a place for his children to be out of the country because he said this winter will be a crisis. And that was before all these things were kind of happening. You could see that beginning to happen. But there was this sense of, everybody could sense when the tension was building. And when the peace talks were announced, you had hope for that, but at the same time, most of the people seemed to have a sense that this was not what was really going to happen, that there was going to be conflict.
I think think an interesting thing, looking at the triangle here, that was incredibly clear to us when we were working in the country, was that, I mean, historically the Catholics, I worked at the Catholic Church, and the Catholics had always been aligned with the army and the rich, and now people were afraid to be identified as Catholics, also Lutherans, because of those churches taking the preferential off for the poor. And it was really your more fundamentalist kinds of churches that kind of now have the government sanction, and we're getting all kinds of money. It was like we'd go out into these really poor villages and we'd see these brand new kind of Assembly of God churches. And we go, where are these peasants getting the money to construct these churches? And that's basically, well, a lot of U.S. money is being sent down to these fundamentalist churches, and they really are kind of right now in the favor of the government and of the army, and a lot of women now wear white. I mean, they've even kind of developed a dress that identifies them with these churches, and the theologies. It's really interesting working with, out in the countryside, working with some of these peasants, and some of them would say to us, they would say, you know, this is our, I remember one man talking to us and just explaining to us that no, God wants us to suffer now. This is our journey, and you know, our liberation is in the next life.
And that's very characteristic of the theology that the Church of Conquest brought with it, and that now is being continued by the more conservative fundamentalist and evangelical churches. This gets a little bit at your question, Ted, about where's the Pope in all this. I think one of the things that is shifting is this whole sense of, in the 1960s, when the Church first began to try and implement Vatican II, it was a sense of, we've got to take the gospel to the poor, we've got to evangelize the poor. And what you hear time and time again from people who did that is, what we found is we were evangelized by the poor. We thought we were going in to bring the gospel. What happened is we learned from living with the poor that they had a much deeper and profounder sense of the gospel, and we in turn were evangelized by them. That gets at a little bit of the question of why the Pope, what the Pope's situation is in all this. I think the Vatican, I'm just going to sketch a couple things. For me, it's helpful to see this diagrammatically a little bit. The I would argue that in the broader context of the whole international Roman Catholic Church right now, headed by the Vatican, that there is a backlash going on against Vatican II, and there is an attempt to reassert hierarchical control over the churches throughout the world. You see this clearly in the placement of new bishops. Whenever a more progressive bishop retires, he is replaced with a bishop who is conservative and aligned with the hierarchy. But it follows along the model of what's been called Christendom, which is you have the church placed at the top of society, and then its power is filtered down through hierarchical structures, including the hierarchy of the church, but also the societal hierarchical structures. And there is a real attempt by the current Roman Catholic Church, headed by Pope John Paul II, to reassert this kind of schema. Now, it creates a paradox, because I do believe that John Paul II is generally concerned with the poor. But I think that he believes strongly that the only way to protect the unity of the Catholic Church is to reach the poor down here through hierarchy and through reasserting control and domination. What is so threatening about liberation theology, what makes people frightened about it, is precisely the sense that the poor themselves are evangelizing us. And so we're learning about the gospel from the perspective of the poor, rather than us telling the poor what the gospel's around. And I've seen people in Latin America put it this way, that the poor form the kind of ground of the society and the church, and therefore the gospel becomes now mediated through the experience of the poor, rather than before, where the gospel was mediated through the experience of power and a hierarchy. What the Pope finds so frightening is that this implies a loss of control. And so he's got a paradox. He goes all over the world and draws enormous numbers of the poor to him. And I think he's generally concerned about them, but he wants to maintain power and control in the way that the poor are ministered to. And so whenever the poor begin to act themselves on the gospel, he and the other sectors of the church become very frightened by that. Is that a fair assessment for me?
I think it kind of actually leads into the next question, too, in terms of how does the church of the poor continue to exist? And I think once, you know, once these people have just experienced this profound liberation and this profound love, that that they can't go back to the old church, that it really is a new church and it's really profoundly changed their lives. I think of how it's influenced me. I think for a long time I kept looking to the church hierarchy in my tradition, priests, nuns, always kind of bestowed upon us the word and how to understand the word. In fact, growing up in a Catholic family, we didn't even have a Bible in our house until after Vatican II. And to suddenly realizing that the real change comes from us changing, from the grassroots, that we can't look. I mean, I still find myself at times looking to the Pope to make this better. It's like, and no, that's not where it's going to happen. And the Salvadorans have experienced that in a very profound way. And in many ways, that has become their faith in recognizing their own experience of God as a community and the tremendous strength in that. And it also continues to be their hope that someday things will be better. They certainly would, for them, for Salvadoran Catholic, it's very painful that their Pope doesn't come and walk with them and kind of understand. But I think that they're not willing to go back to the old way either.
Where is the local hierarchy right now? Is that siding with the Pope or with the poor? The local bishops and archbishops?
Well, it's interesting. Even during the time of Archbishop Romero, he was a minority perspective in the Council of Bishops in El Salvador. How many here have seen the movie Romero? Oh, quite a few of you have. That becomes very clear in the movie Romero, where they have the conversations and the meetings. And I mean, ironically, one of the Salvadoran bishops is a colonel, holds the title of colonel in the Salvadoran military. As you can imagine, where his loyalties lie, he's the chaplain to the army. And so Romero and one other bishop, a fellow named Arturo Rivera y Damas, were really the two progressive voices in the Salvadoran bishops of a group of, I think, six bishops at that time. Rivera y Damas is the current archbishop. He was the one who replaced Romero. He's taken a very different role, I think, quite intentionally from the one Romero did. Romero sided explicitly with the poor. And I brought this little book. It's a picture of him. It says, La voz de los sin voz, the voice of the voiceless. Romero really took upon himself to be the voice of the poor and the voiceless. Rivera y Damas has taken a different role. I think he believes that is really the church is maybe the only institution that can bring about some reconciliation in society. So he's very explicitly set himself up as a mediator position between the conflicted sides. And so when he denounces the human rights abuses of the army and so forth, he also calls the guerrillas to account in terms of abuses, that kind of thing. He's been a more intermediate role. He, I think, though, still his primary focus has been ending the conflict. And so it would be hard to peg him on either side. He does actions that would fall, favor both, I suppose. There was one thing when Maureen was talking a little bit about this change, it gets to the question of how does the church continue to exist? I want to address that a little bit, but Maureen and I were talking ahead of time about this one story that's reached, it sort of has a status of legend or myth at this point now, because several of us have heard it and don't know the exact details, but it went something along the lines of, when a colleague, the source I think was a colleague of Marines, when he was in the countryside and talking with the Salvadoran Campesino, and it was relatively recently after the army had been through and the community had done a lot of things working together and the army had come through and destroyed it. And this North American church worker said to this Campesino, when the revolution comes, things will really be different, and we can really build. And the campesino said to him, he said, oh, you don't understand. The revolution has already happened. We are a changed people, and we're never going back to the way we were before. The war may still be continuing, but the revolution has already taken place. And I think that really gets at the heart of what's happening in places like El Salvador, where the poor are now no longer passively listening to orders from the church authorities, but understand themselves to be the church. And he later went on to say, they can kill us all, but the revolution has already taken place. And so there was a sense of something irreversible had already happened. That, I think, it helps address this question of how does it continue to exist? Because one of the things that I think marks the Salvadoran church is this, one, incredible willingness to put their lives on the line, but also incredible ingenuity in terms of a survival people. You have people, Marina's lived in communities where you literally have a mobile community, a mobile church, I mean, where people live on the run, and they worship on the run, and they find ways they can't afford to put roots down because the army comes through and destroys their communities. In the urban settings, it's a church of almost the catacombs. The church has gone underground. They've had to find ways that are clandestine. And part of it is El Salvador, the reality of El Salvador is that it goes through periodic pulses of repression. There'll be times when the repression is very great, and then the church basically goes underground. There'll be other times when it lifts for a while. They call it political space there. There's more political space. And it's possible to do things more openly. Always knowing, however, the risk of doing anything openly is that people are noting that activity for the time when the repression returns. A political scientist in Guatemala described it for me, and he said, the reality here is the violence goes up, the violence goes down, the violence never goes away. So there's always a sense of, even in times when there's more political space than you can operate, you have to be careful about what's being noted for the later times when the violence returns. And yet the church has found ways to as one of you was saying, El Salvador is a small country. When you've been there for a while, you begin to realize this. And basically, after a while, everybody knows everybody. And people know when things are going to be happening. And so the church is always trying to read the signs of the time in terms of knowing what it can get away with and what it can't, in terms of operating openly or not. One of the most powerful experiences I had is worshiping in a base community experience of a community called Sacamillo, which is in San Salvador. And we were talking with a group of widows. It was the women of the church. They all happened to be widows because all of their husbands had been killed. And they mentioned to us that over 600 people from their church had been killed by the army. I was just floored. I cannot imagine being in a church where 600 people have been killed in the space of 10 years or so. And they had many, many more. This was before the November uprising. Many, many more were killed in November. And yet they continue to find ways to be church in that. And
I think a follow-up that I remember asking one man who had suffering the past years, he'd lost most of his family, and I asked him, how do you keep going? I mean, it's like, I'm not going to give it up. I mean, and he said, we no longer hope for ourselves, we hope for our children. And I thought, oh, wow. I mean, I don't think in those kinds of, that kind of future. I mean, I've just grown up in such an egocentric society. It's just, I thought, gosh, that's an incredible kind of hope to have. And I think they also have a sense of the long haul. And I remember one time somebody was asking a campesino about, they were having a party, and they said, gee, you know, how can you have a party right now? It's like, there's so much to do. And they said, you know, they just looked at this, it was actually a North American that asked the question, they looked at the North American, and they said, well, obviously you're not in it for the long haul. You know, and I remember another time, it was lunchtime or something, and I was actually spending some time with one of these groups of people that were mobile, that had to flee and hide whenever the army would come through, and it was lunchtime, and to be honest, I didn't feel like eating beans and tortillas again, because that's basically what we ate three times a day, so I was just going to skip a meal. And this campesino looked at me, and he said, but Maureen, they said, we eat when there's food. He says, we don't suffer if we don't have to.
That's one of the things I think for me, one of the real paradoxes about where I'm evangelized by the witness there. The people I've met there, by no means, the last thing in the world they're doing is seeking martyrdom. They're not seeking to be martyrs. They become martyrs because they really believe the gospel, and they believe that finally death does not have the last say. John and Tram and I were talking about this in terms of the power of nonviolent witness. And it's what infuriates the army there. When the final authority says, if you don't do it, I'll kill you, and someone finally says, fine, you can kill me, but that's still not the last word. It really shakes the questions of the authority figures there. And that's what I think is so threatening, these are people who have finally, they really do believe when Jesus says you can kill the body, but you can't kill the soul, or that when Archbishop Romero says, if they kill me, I will be resurrected in the struggles of the Salvadoran people. And that was basically a prophetic statement that has come true. You can't go into a home in El Salvador now, into a rural home or a poor person's home, without seeing a picture of Archbishop Romero there. He has been resurrected time and again in these people. And so it's a people who do not seek martyrdom and yet are perfectly willing to experience martyrdom because they really believe what the gospel said to them.
It was 5 years ago when I had this encounter, but I met with a priest who was exiled from El Salvador, who was working with refugees, particularly with children, trying to establish a place to raise and educate refugee children in Mexico. His argument was that, I mean, you're talking about not killing the soul. He was saying that we have literally lost a generation, that the children, there is no young male who is not either in the army, drafted into the army, or who is in hiding someplace. There's no normal place to be educated, to grow up. Where will the leaders of the country, this man was arguing, where will the leaders of the country be when we finally get somewhere to be that? We've lost that whole generation, which was a really, it was a very serious kind of statement I think he was making about the hopefulness for the future of the country. And the longer that the intensity of the repression continues, it just eliminates a whole chunk of the history. And I can hear the faithfulness in folks, but also that aspect of how will the country be rebuilt when there's been so much damage.
It's I think one of the real tragedies of what's happening with the church there as well. I mean, like, I remember thinking when the 6 Jesuits were massacred, you know, this, granted, a life is a life, and 70,000 people have died, but what part of what struck me so tragic about these Jesuits were really part of the incredible leadership core that had been working for years about how to reconcile the society, and then had been literally staking their lives on how to do that. And it was such a loss. And there's many, many examples of the anonymous folks we never hear about, the same thing, people who have that tremendous experience. So it is, one of the real tragedies there, that so many of those people are the people who get lost.
Yeah, one of the concerns, I remember seeing pictures of the disappeared, and it was one of the things that was being raised up at that time was that the level of violence had significantly decreased. This was in 85. And of course, it had to decrease because American aid was threatened to be reduced if it didn't decrease. But the statement was also made, well, there really isn't anybody left to kill. All of those who had been in leadership roles had largely been killed. And that didn't have to kill anybody else, and that all you needed now was a little bit of periodic violence just to remind people of what might happen. And so it was easier to lower the level of violence.
It doesn't take much to maintain a climate of terror once you've had the initial impression.
I think, but kind of despite what you're saying, it's like there's still these communities. For example, the two refugee camps in Honduras, Mesa Grande, which had 10,000 refugees, which is where I work, there's another refugee camp of 8,000 people, another one of 3,000, and all almost all but 1,000 or so of those people have returned to their homes in the conflicted zones and have started up these communities that and they're operated in a very cooperative kind of way. They're really revolutionary communities, and there's probably, 15 of them, 10 to 15 of these communities scattered in the countryside now, where people are doing cooperative farming and animal husbandry, and they have sewing co-ops, and people give so much of their time to the community, and they get so much time to work in their own little fields, and they're tremendously exciting communities. And they said, and basically the thought, when these people were becoming very despairing in the refugee camps, and this has just happened over the past couple of years, and they just said, gosh, you know, this, we've learned a lot of skills here in the camps about how to work together, and now we want to take those home and begin working in our own country towards peace. And this is the way we can do this, by going back to our country and rebuilding these new communities.
Yeah, Jody.
Just at the end, I wonder whether, I know the focus is on the church in El Salvador, but I wonder whether you could just say a word about U.S. policy and what we need to be pushing on in terms of aid at this point.